Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to look at spontaneous breast cancer remissions. How's that possible? But it is. Ellagic acid. Why you should have that in your diet. The omega-3 fatty acids are able to help you if you have aggressive prostate cancer. Also, heart health, urinary and gastrointestinal tract, and other metabolic benefits of a certain fruit. And I'll share that with you as well. And all this along with a buffalo berry. Have you ever heard of a buffalo berry? Well, it's an interesting fruit, and according to the Journal of Food Science, it's the next superfruit. All of this comes every day from mainstream, independent, peer-reviewed science. Then we go to our environmental segment and an in-depth discussion on the true science behind genetically modified foods. A special report from Paul Fassa. From our public health segment, corporate espionage and the secret war against citizen activism. You knew that the National Security Agency was spying on you. But what if you're just a person who's against nuclear, or you're against gas hydrofracking, or against GMOs? Then corporate America could be spying on you, and does. I'll give you the specifics from the Center for Corporate Policy, a Ralph Nader-affiliated essential action group showing you what they're doing and have been doing to us. From also our public health segment today, Bill Gates' polio vaccine program eradicates children, not polio. From VacTruth, the latest on our concerns. My guest in the second part of our program would be Dr. Carolyn Baker. Dr. Baker is a professor in history and psychology. We're going to talk about how to remain conscious during the inevitable collapse of our modern industrial civilization. It doesn't collapse all at once. It collapses gradually, over a period of time. Just look at the inner cities of the United States. Camden, New Jersey, Compton, California, Detroit. These didn't happen in a week. It took decades. So how do we cope? And what does it mean to live in a collapsing society? We'll discuss it and still maintain a transformative mindset in turbulent times. A very powerful insight. Women are leading the way in sustainable and organic agriculture. Good, good, good. More on that. And drones, tanks, and grenade launchers coming soon to every police department in the United States. Tanks. That's right. Drones. And full body vests, like they wear in Afghanistan and Iraq. Why do they need that? They don't. But the people that manufacture them do. The complete militarization of America. Also, for those groups out there that you see an expert talking on MSNBC or being quoted, these are not real experts. These are policy wonks. A new report exposes the pressure groups masquerading as think tanks, and we'll give you that. Just one quick program announcement to our sister stations in West Virginia, Miami, all over across the United States, and especially to WBAI, where you're listening to this program right now live and have for almost 38 years, and WPFW in Washington, D.C., where you're listening live. Tomorrow's a big day. A one-hour, original, in-depth investigative report, The Hidden Hand. You have not heard this. You haven't read it. I've worked 9 months on this, and it was just handed back today from our legal and scholars in-house who said, go. So we're going with it. You won't want to miss it. It'll take the entire hour. It'll then be posted on our different sites. My hope is that you will let people know that a very important report, one that no one in America on any radio or television program has ever done before. And you should know by now, if you listen to me, that when I do something, I do it with scholarship. I do not do something everyone else has done. The hidden hand, it'll explain why our world is the way it is today, all the people that supposedly are talking on our behalf, how we've been sold out, who's behind it, and it's not the people you think. But the people who are behind it, I'll expose. Their names, their corporations, how they work, the media that they have controlled, how it all happens. Is it by intent? Or is this just what happens when you get enough sociopathic personalities together who have their own needs and will use any means to get that? You'll hear it all tomorrow, so please pass it on. A one-hour special, unlike anything you've ever heard before on radio. The Hidden Hand, tomorrow, fully referenced. This could withstand a court of law, so you don't want to miss this. Please let people know. Also, if any of you have received any personal emails from me, that is an intruder who has managed to get on. We have corrected that. I don't send personal emails. I don't Twitter. I don't Facebook. I don't do any of that. But and we've had people try to hack in and successfully hack in online at BAI and our other site. Our site will be back up tomorrow. And this was done when we were doing our special investigative report and on JFK. Hopefully, it won't happen tomorrow during that show. Let's begin. I've seen women reverse breast cancer. It takes time. The more the alternative therapies they engage in, the quicker it is. Generally, it's between 1 to 3 years. This is the latest from Christina Sarich of Natural Society. She's concerned. We're all concerned. And we can all look towards one man, Dr. Samuel Epstein, who made this his life's work of showing us the danger, the fraud of mammography and radiation prescriptions to supposedly cure cancer. Well, there are numerous cases now in the literature that shows that cancer, breast cancer, will go away all by itself. Now, radiation, the primary means, if not invasive surgery, to eradicate breast cancer, works by killing off cells, by exposing the DNA to ionizing radiation waves. Now, here's the problem. The treatment also kills off healthy cells and has even been shown to cause breast cancer. In a study published at Dartmouth Medical School, the taboo subject of spontaneous remission is openly discussed. This is rare. One of the doctors who helped write up the findings, a Dr. Gilbert Welch, MD, made sure they were published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, a respected journal. The study compared 100,000 Norwegian women, ages 50 to 64, who were divided into two groups, with women in both groups having invasive cancers. So you have 100,000 women who have cancer of the breast. And they were followed for 5 years. And here's what they found. The women in the first group only had one screening during that five-year period. But the people in the second group, where they were given six breast screenings, meaning six mammographies. Here's the interesting statistic. This is what we've been saying for decades. Those that received the breast screenings each year had 22% higher breast cancer rates, invasive breast cancer. Now, what this researcher pointed out, that since exposure to the phthalates is widespread, and because the prevalence of radiation in our society is common, and we don't even question it any longer, that when you're exposing breast tissue to radiation, you're also destroying so many healthy cells. And in a person who already has breast cancer, there's a high probability that person has a defective immune system, or why would they have breast cancer to begin with? Meaning after 20 or 30 or 40 years of exposure, maybe cigarette smoking, maybe alcohol, maybe poor diet, maybe background radiation, whatever the original underlying causes, once they had the breast cancer, then to continue to give them radiation is what increases the risk. And yet in the United States, we don't caution women about getting x-rays. In fact, we think that a woman is doing the right thing by preventing cancer, by having completely healthy breasts, even in young girls, teenagers, every year, get your mammography. This is the worst information we could give. This is an assault against women's body. This is medical malpractice, and it must be stopped. This is just one study that took a look at this. There is an acid, it's called ELAGIC, E-L-L-A-G-I-C. This involves cervical, breast, and prostate cancers. And evidently, the latest research on this ELAGIC acid, which is a phytochemical, a polyphenol, that your body produces in the large intestine, is also found in many foods. And it's very important because it's been shown to impact in a positive way multiple cancers, including cervical, breast, and prostate cancers. In recent studies, ellagic acid, according to Sarich, and its metabolized products were found concentrated in the prostate tissue, and especially when fed in the form of pomegranates, and in human subjects who were suffering from enlarged prostate or cancerous growths in the tissue of the prostate, those fed pomegranate juice or who ate almonds for 3 days prior to a surgery were found to have lesser prostate cancer cells than those that did not consume these foods. This was published in the journal Molecular Nutrition and Food Research. Quote, co-treatment with low concentrations of EA and UA dramatically decrease cell proliferation, exhibiting synergism in PC3 cells evaluated by isobiographic analysis and combination index. These data provide information on pomegranate metabolites for the prevention of prostate cancer recurrence, supporting the role of gut flora-derived metabolites for cancer prevention, end quote. What does that mean? And why do I quote these? I quote them because I want you to see what the actual science says. It's showing that by having pomegranates fresh, where the juice or concentrate, you're helping if you have prostate cancer, breast cancer, and other cancers. Now, that's not alone. There's another journal, the Clinical Cancer Research, where patients were given just 8 ounces of pomegranate juice daily, and they saw a decrease in cancerous tissue. But they're not alone. We found 3 dozen other studies that prove that eating foods high in ellagic acid, such as pomegranate, help reduce prostate cancer. Now, this incredible phytonutrient has not only been proven to fight cervical cancers, with surprising efficiency, a study coming from Hollings Cancer Institute at the University of South Carolina found that over 500 women studied, all of whom had cervical cancer, 85% of participants experienced what is called G arrest of cancerous cells within 48 to 72 hours by increasing their ellagic acid consumption. And so that's important. And also the pomegranate causes cancer cells to create cancer suicide. And that's been confirmed for breast cancer, pancreatic cancer, skin, colon, esophageal cancers as well. And the ellagic acid works primarily by stopping mitosis, cancer cell division. And further studies are showing ellagic acid inhibits mutagenesis and carcinogenesis by forming adducts with DNA, thus masking binding sites to be occupied by a mutagen or carcinogenic agent. And it simply is great for us. So, what's the takeaway message? Pomegranate, raspberries, strawberries, blackberries, cranberries, walnuts, and pecans. Those are all rich in ellagic acid. Finally, omega-3 is linked to reducing prostate cancer aggression. This is in the University of California, Los Angeles. And here's what it says. Quote, A follow-up study reveals that men suffering from prostate cancer who took fish oil supplements alongside of a low-fat diet demonstrated changes in their cancer tissue that may indicate reduced cancer aggression. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Prevention Research. And for the men in the audience, prostate cancer is the most common cancer among American men. About 230 to 250,000 new cases will happen this year. And so a low-fat diet, which is a vegan diet, and making sure you get your teaspoon of flaxseed oil or 2,000 units of the omega-3 fatty acids each day, that'll do it. That'll help you. And that'll help save your prostate. So that's the latest on health and nutrition. Now we're going to shift gears here and go into our environmental segment. This is from Paul Fassa, and it's about GMOs. At any time that you have an extra hour and a half, please go to Gary and All TV, YouTube, you'll see it, and you can download full free as a public service, Seeds of Death. Join the more than million people on just that one site. There are multiple sites it's on who have done this, because the more information you have, the more voices of reason within the activism movement, science, medicine, food policy, and they're all in here, from Vandana Shiva, who we filmed at her ashram at the foot of the Himalayan mountains in India, to France and Scotland, Ireland, Canada, Midwest Farms, filmed all over for this documentary. It shows you the truth about why we should be stopping all genetically modified food. This is what Paul has to say. The article will be posted today. It's entitled True GMO Science and Dangers You'll Never Hear About from the Media. Quote, the mainstream media usually lamely refers to GMO issues as an undecided debate or controversy, depicting anti-GMO people as emotional, unreasonable, while claiming genetic engineering is more scientific. But the only science the mainstream media is exposing is biotech industry science. The fact is, numerous studies point out the GMO dangers, and hundreds of scientists are beginning to publicly speak out against GMOs at large. Now, this audience is familiar with a very famous French study conducted by a Dr. Cerellini and his whole team, and they took GMO corn and Roundup's active ingredient glyphosate used for GMO Roundup ready seeds, and they fed it to rats. And the rats, after 4 months, began to develop cancerous tumors, and they got bigger and bigger until in one of the shots you see the tumor is actually larger than the rest of the body of the rat. Well, Cerellini's 2-year trial was trashed by the biotech industry sycophants as unscientific, and the mainstream media accepted what trash that they were given. They did not question it. Those so-called journalists at the New York Times and other places, they should have really done objective, independent research. The rats Cerellini used were the same type used by Monsanto for their study to gain approval for their GMO corn. The difference is their study only lasted 3 months. So a Monsanto approved study was 3 months long. But then I began to look at all the scientific literature and found almost everyone only did a 3-month study. Why? Because the cancer doesn't start until about the 4th or 5th month. So if you were to say, look, we've had 100 studies, and they've all shown that there's no damage. If you were an average journalist and you stop there, you will be complicit in disseminating misinformation. But if you ask, well, what is the longest study ever done? Have any been done for the full life of, let's say, 2 years of the rat? The answer had been no. Well, this one was done for 2 years, and the cancer only began to appear, so it lets me imagine, or at least speculate, or hypothesize, that the entire industry and all of its scientists and all of its board of directors and all the people who are policymakers knew that if you went by a certain date, there's a high probability that your rats in your study would end up causing cancer, getting cancer, and you then wouldn't be able to say you had a safe product. So that's what this tells us. Seralini was more appropriate for long-term effects, and he added low glyphosate doses measured as equivalent to byproduct consumption of Monsanto's GMO corn. And so that shows that Seralini got it right. The good news is Seralini's study has been validated by the European Food Safety Authority. Did that get covered by the mainstream media? No. But even before this controversy, scientists who know genes and microbiology but weren't bought and funded by Monsanto and their ilk were expressing grave concerns about the promoter gene used for GMO products. The Organic and Non-GMO Report interviewed agroecologist Dan Lauder, Ph.D., about his paper. The paper is entitled The Genetic Engineering for Food and the Failure of Science. This is published in the International Journal of Sociology and Agriculture and Food. Now, despite knowing how this paper might affect his career as a university researcher and professor, Professor Lauder revealed more than the flawed scientific background of the biotechnology arrogance. He also revealed a smoking gun that would ruin our health. Quote, the promoter gene used in genetically engineered crops, the cauliflower mosaic virus, is a powerful promoter of interspecies gene expression and exchange. Scientists thought it would be denatured in our digestive system, but it is not. It has been shown to promote the transfer of transgenes from genetically modified foods to the bacteria within our digestive system, which are responsible for 80% of our immune system function. End quote. Now, what's really concerning here? You've never seen this. You've never heard this. You didn't know a doctor, Professor Don Lauder, L-O-T-T-E-R, even existed. You didn't know about the International Journal of Sociology or of Agriculture and Food. You didn't hear the article, The Genetic Engineering of Food and the Failure of Science. And most importantly, the scientists, the nurses, the physicians, the activists, the educators, the teachers who can disseminate this information did not know that, quote, the promoter gene used in genetically engineered crops, this virus, cauliflower virus, is a powerful promoter of interspecies gene exchange. We thought, scientists thought, that it would be denatured in our digestive system, but it is not. It has been shown to promote the transfer of transgenes from GM foods to the bacteria within our digestive system, which are responsible for 80% of our immune system function, end quote. Now, Professor Lauder added, there are even worse concerns about this promoter gene, the cauliflower mosaic virus, or what's called CAMV335S, used for plant genetic engineering, is cited by most independent scientists as a source of viral recombination, as well as gene silencer and DNA disruptor. What does this mean in lay language? Means that what they've been doing across all these different species could spread viral disease and genetic havoc horizontally across plant, animal, and human life while simultaneously suppressing our immune systems. Now, their independent science have corroborated Professor Lauder's assessment of the CAMV35S promoter gene dangers. There are numerous other studies available showcasing the negative effects and dangers of GMOs. Do not rely upon official explanations. Here's my thoughts on this, with some reservation and some exception. The vast majority of our bureaucracies today give official positions that are based upon internal politics, with enormous influence by outside forces. Just imagine what you'll get if you call the USDA or the FDA. The person running food safety at the FDA came from Monsanto, a lawyer at Monsanto. The person running the USDA was the genetic engineering governor of America, Tom Vilsack. So they're going to give you the official industry talking points. Now, there are honest, dedicated people within all bureaucracies, but rare do we hear from them. They're a great risk if they speak out. All the more do we encourage those who do speak out to tell us the full truth, because we're not getting the truth from official sources. So, we have been treated like laboratory rats. That's why I eat only organic, wherever possible, and stay away from GMOs, but educate yourself. Watch Seeds of Death, and then read the article. Dozens of articles that we have up there. Now on to corporate espionage and the secret war against citizen activism from Common Dreams. There is a chilling report that unveils the well-funded and shadowy world of corporate espionage of social justice organizations. They infiltrate them, they intrude, they spy, they wiretap, and more. We're not talking about the government now. That we know does. These are corporations. This is all according to the Center for Corporate Policy, a project of the Ralph Nader-affiliated Essential Action. These are what he calls Pinkerton thugs. They're staffed by former law enforcement, CIA, National Security Agency, FBI, and military employees. They're funded by some of the biggest named corporations in the world and backed by highly secretive investigative firms that operate as spy agencies for the private sector. There's a 53-page study called Spooky Business that pieces together nearly 20 years of information exposing this hidden wing of the private sector, which its author, Gary Ruskin, says, quote, is just the tip of the iceberg. And while targets run the gamut from anti-war to workers' rights groups to environmental organizations, they appear to all have one thing in common. They are perceived as a threat to the corporate bottom line. Quote, the key finding of the report is that corporations are conducting espionage against nonprofit organizations, said Ruskin in an interview. Quote, this is entirely veiled in secrecy and is a threat to an active citizenry, democracy, and the right to privacy. Now, let's be specific here. Who are these people? Well, some of them, U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Walmart, Monsanto, Bank of America, Dow Chemical, Kraft, Coca-Cola, Chevron, Burger King, McDonald's, Shell, British Petroleum, BAE, Sasol, Brown & Williamson. The report summary states, quote, the most prevalent tactic appears to be infiltration by posing a volunteer or journalist to obtain information from a nonprofit. But corporations have been linked to many other human, physical, and electronic espionage tactics against nonprofits. Let's be specific now. Throughout the 1990s, Greenpeace organized a campaign against chlorine used in the manufacture of paper. In response, Dow hired private firms that dug through Greenpeace trash and recycling to access internal documents, posed as volunteers to spy on the office, conducted wiretap surveillance of the Greenpeace office, and stole confidential information from the organization. In 2010, journalist Mary Cuddy revealed that the private investigative firm Kroll had attempted to recruit her to pose as a journalist while actually spying for Chevron in Ecuador. At the time, the massive oil company was fighting a multi-billion-dollar fine for an oil spill around Lago in Ecuador. In 2006, Walmart sent an employee to infiltrate and secretly wire a meeting of Up Against the Wall in Fayetteville, Arkansas. And then it goes on, one example after another. So what is the takeaway message here? On the one hand, we're told that we have a democracy. We have a Bill of Rights. We have a Constitution. We have freedom of speech and assembly. Well, since when is it legal for any corporation to wiretap your offices, your home, to provide provocateurs, to hack your computers, to read your private mail? We know that the government has been illegally doing it. Now we know, thanks to this report, that corporations have been spying on anyone that is perceived as a threat to their bottom line. So why don't we ask? Oh, I forgot, we can't ask this Attorney General anything, can we? Because he wouldn't listen to us. We're not his next employer. So what can we do? We can't ask our legislators. They're corrupt. We can't ask our state legislators. Alec has bought them, many of them. Where do we go? The media? No, they're not the ones who expose this. MSNBC? They're clowns. Fox? No, they're not on our side. So this is why citizen action groups are important. Just be aware that if you're doing something important to make it a better world, there's a high probability, if it represents a financial threat, that you'll be infiltrated. Let's finally take a look at Bill Gates. He's the wealthiest man in the world. I saw yesterday that he's worth about $79 billion. This is in fact truth. Quote, Bill Gates' polio vaccine program eradicates children, but not polio. I'll quote this. In the depths of cyberspace lurks a press release written by the CDC confirming that the oral polio vaccine given to millions of children throughout the developing world is causing them to develop vaccine-induced polio. Instead of banning the vaccination, as one would expect, the CDC has decided, in its wisdom, that the best way to tackle the problem is to maintain a high rate of vaccination in all countries. Yes, that is correct. The CDC recommends maintaining a high rate of vaccinations, vaccinating as many children as possible with a vaccine that causes polio. What is the proof? Well, I have the article. This is from the CDC, and it was released under Update on Vaccine-Derived Poliovirus, April 2011 through June 2012. Quote, in 1988, the World Health Assembly resolved to eradicate poliomyelitis worldwide. One of the main tools used in polio eradication efforts has been the live, attenuated, oral poliovirus vaccine. This inexpensive vaccine is administered easily by mouth, makes recent recipients resistant to infection by wild poliovirus, and provides long-term protection against paralytic disease through durable humoral immunity. Nonetheless, now here's where you got to listen. This is the proof of it. Nonetheless, rare cases of vaccine-associated paralytic poliomyelitis can occur both among immunologically normal oral polio vaccine recipients and their contacts among persons who are immunodeficient. In addition, vaccine-derived polio viruses can emerge to cause polio outbreaks in areas with low coverage and can replicate for years in persons who are immunodeficient. End quote. Now, this is due to the vaccine we're talking about. This is the CDC's own words. Quote, it continues, the VDPVs can cause paralytic polio in humans, that's the vaccine, and have the potential for sustained circulation and biologically and differ from most vaccine-related poliovirus. Isolates have having genetic properties consistent with prolonged replication or transmission. Were first identified by sequence analysis of poliovirus isolates. Okay. In order for governments to pass this idea on to the public of mass vaccinate programs being efficient, they are fully backed by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, a group that has made it very clear that their aim is to wipe out wild polio from the planet. The Gates Foundation appears to be ignorant of the fact that they are causing tens of thousands of children to suffer from vaccine-induced polio. And while a large majority of us look on in sheer horror at the number of children who now suffer life-threatening disabilities caused by vaccine itself, vaccine-crazed individuals at the CDC, the FDA, and the Gates Foundation have decided to step up the polio campaign by hiring an array of Hollywood and Bollywood stars in order to motivate the people. The Polio Global Eradication Initiative, founded in 1988 by the World Health Organization and the U.S. CDC, stated that there were only 42 cases of wild polio reported in India. Well, then, if you have so few cases of polio in a country with 1.3 billion people, you only have 42 cases in all of India, why would you vaccinate people and end up with thousands, tens of thousands of people now who have polio because of the vaccine? And this is part of the problem when we select bureaucracy over democracy. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. And one last thing before we go to our guest who is standing by. This is from John Whitehead. It says the following: drones, tanks, and grenade launchers coming soon to a police department near you. The argument for up-arming is always based upon the least likely of terrorist scenarios. Anyone can get a gun and shoot up stuff. No amount of SWAT equipment can stop that. So says a former terror expert with the Congressional Research Services. So why does a police department, which hasn't had an officer killed in the line of duty in over 125 years, in a town of less than 20,000 people, need tactical military vests like those used by soldiers in Afghanistan? And for that matter, why does a police department in a city of 35,000 need a military-grade helicopter? And what possible use could police at Ohio State University have for acquiring a heavily armored vehicle intended to withstand an IED blast? Why are police departments across the country acquiring heavy-duty military equipment and weaponry? For the same reason that perfectly good roads get repaved, perfectly good equipment gets retired and replaced, and perfectly good employees spend their days twiddling their thumbs and all at taxpayers' expense. It's called make-work programs, except in this case, instead of unnecessary busy work to keep people employed, communities across America are finding themselves supposedly gifted with drones, tanks, grenade launchers, and other military equipment better suited to the battlefield. And this was all documented in a report called A Government of Wolves, The Emerging American Police State. And so we pay for it, private corporations manufacture it, and local police departments get it. Why do they need this? They don't. And that's what happens when we have the militarization of the police. Let us now go to my guest who is standing by to talk about how to remain conscious during the inevitable collapse of our modern industrial civilization. She is Dr. Carolyn Baker, a professor in history and psychology. She writes articles that are posted on Countercurrents. She's written several books critiquing America's religious fundamentalist culture and modern education. Her most recent one is Collapsing Consciousness, Transformative Truths for Turbulent Times. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. It's really nice to be here this morning.
There are two daunting issues people face that don't get a lot of attention, and because they are primarily invisible threats, they remain in the realms of the abstract. And unlike an economic collapse that happens and we immediately see the consequences, we don't readily observe when its real dangers will strike us. And the first is catastrophic climate change and global warming. So let's begin with that and describe for us the nature of the fears we have regarding climate change's impact upon our lives.
Well, the resources on this, the information is huge. It's difficult sometimes to dig it out, beyond what mainstream media gives us. One person whose work I highly respect and have been relying on is Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus from University of Arizona. He is not a climate scientist, but he compiles some of the latest research regularly on his blog, Nature Bats Last, and he's written a wonderful article called How Do We Act in the Face of Climate Chaos? You can Google that and find that at Arctic News, How Do We Act in the Face of Climate Chaos, which gives some of the latest research. And we're really looking at, according to some of these really distinguished scientists, we're really looking at the possibility of, by the year 2030, 2040, at least by mid-century, there being no places on Earth that are really habitable that can sustain human life or even the life of other species. And certainly by the end of the century, we might be looking at a planet in which there's no life at all. So these are things that are not getting generally reported in mainstream news or even progressive websites where we talk about climate conferences and that sort of thing. It's really, really way out of control now, and it's very questionable as to whether or not we could even stop climate change if we did everything tomorrow that is causing it. If we stopped everything tomorrow that is causing it, could we actually reverse it? And that's really open to question.
Not in the world I live in. I've spent 7 years full-time on a documentary and a major textbook on the 12 tipping points, hundreds of interviews with a leading climatologist. Without exception, they say we are in chaos theory and nothing we can do at this point going forward will stop the at least four of the tipping points from tipping, including global warming. And even now, we are now projecting, in not the 100 years, we're projecting in the next 4 or 5 years, another single-digit increase, which means greater melting of Greenland, greater melting of Antarctica, the possibility of having double the amount of extreme weather events. Let me give you an example. Last year, there was 112,000 unique weather events. Over 11,000 of those were in the United States, meaning the worst, the coldest, the hottest, the most rain, things we've never experienced before in our history. Those are going to double now. And we had, look at Hurricane Sandy, that was a Category 1. Mm-hmm. We're going to be hit with Category 3, 4, and 5. So we're going to have the tornadoes worse. We're going to have drought worse. We're going to have loss of our water. We're going to have some major upheavals. The question is this. And I know you address this, Carolyn. We can continue to say we need to discuss it. We need to keep an open mind about it. But be the farmer who I drove by and on my trip across America and see where his farm, after 120 years of having the same family generation, there's no more water. It's all pumped out.
Right.
So that's gone. That's a reality. He can't reverse. And everywhere in America, you're seeing this happen. So we're beyond this question. Can we slow it down and reverse it? We don't have the political or economic will to reverse or slow down anything at the corporate or at the major government level. We do as individuals, but we as individuals can only do so much. So I think that we had better look at what can we do individually, collectively, knowing that it's about to happen and is happening as we speak. Your thoughts, please.
Well, the wrong question that is often asked of me is, where do I go where it's safe? Well, there is no place on the planet where it's safe. There's no place that's exempt from climate chaos. And my work is about helping people deal with their fears, their anger, their grief, their despair as they face these crises. And, you know, how do we live well as we shut the lights out on a planet in our own individual lives? Guy McPherson is continually saying these days we're living in a state of hospice. And so how do we live in hospice? Hospice isn't the worst place in the world to live. In fact, a lot of people say that it was the greatest experience of their lives. You know, they really got in touch with their feelings. They had a good quality of life. They had a chance to reflect. They had an opportunity to make amends for certain things in their lives. So I think that attitude is really not a bad way to live, and it's becoming more urgent to have the hospice attitude with every passing day.
It was Friedrich Nietzsche who said there are no facts, only interpretations. And I've had in-depth conversation on this topic with McPherson. He is, for many people, he's a scary person to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
There's a second danger on the horizon, and that's the drift of radioactivity to our west coast and to the larger ramifications of a disaster ensuing from the removal of the fuel rods. If there's one single error in removing a single rod, it can cause all those rods to explode, releasing what would be equivalent to 106 nuclear power sites that could be adversely affected, massive radiation that would come forward. Yet we pay no attention to the United States, even in California. They pay little to no attention in the media or the legislature or most people about we're going to be hit with massive amounts of radiation in the debris in the water and also in the fish and in the air. And we already have instances of thyroid irregularities in children. Why can't they face this fact and deal with it?
Well, you're absolutely right, because on top of catastrophic climate change, we have Fukushima. The one website that I go to every single day to check this out is Energy News, ENENews.com. And there are a number of people who are talking about it and trying to deal with it consciously. But when you put Fukushima on top of catastrophic climate change and what you've just said about the fuel rods, we are looking at something that is absolutely daunting, because humanity is really right now between a rock and a hard place in a way that it never has been before. You know, some people are saying, well, you know, let's collapse industrial civilization. Let's stop this growth. Let's shut down this nightmare called industrial civilization. The truth is, you know, if we all got off the grid, if the grid collapsed, we'd have the meltdown of over 400 nuclear power plants around the world, because nuclear power plants have to have the electrical grid. So, you know, and then the other side is that if we continue with this disastrous industrial civilization, we will hasten catastrophic climate change. So here we are. That's why I say we're in a hospice situation.
I've counseled a lot of people in hospice, and where I certainly can understand your empathizing with those who have come to grips with issues that they have not resolved previously in their life. They're doing so because there is only one more step they take, that is death. They're not going from a hospice back into life, though that is possible. I've actually seen that happen. My concern is not waiting to the end of our lives to finally come to some introspection that allows us to rebalance ourselves.
It
was Albert Camus who said nothing is more despicable than respect based upon fear. And I don't want people to fear everything before they get their attention, fearing a heart attack, fearing bankruptcy, fearing divorce, fearing death. I'd rather them come from a more enlightened place. Now let me just add this in, then please take your time answering this. Many commentators have been arguing that the demise of our civilization has been in the process for a long time and has already reached its apex, and Western society is now in a steady descent, and we see it in bits and pieces. You know, when a fun game is bashing someone in a sucker punch inside the head and killing them, that seems to be a new form of UFO entertainment. But for many of us, that's a sign of how far we have dropped off the scale of spirituality, ethics, decency, morality, and what kind of free fall our society is in. Not all of society, but those that allow that. Even when I see the Hunger Games, oh, I got an idea. How about us spending $150 million, $200 million to make a movie showing something really neat? Let's have a bunch of wealthy adults or bored adults betting on which children can kill children in mutilating ways. Now, that should be really interesting and fun, shouldn't it? And it becomes number one film in the world, earning $168 million. What does that tell us about the people that go see that, the people that read the book? It tells us that's an extension of ourselves. However, when we look at climate change, tipping points, and other intangible triggers that would disrupt the balance of life as we know it, we're facing the possibilities of some immediate flash change. Hurricane Sandy that I mentioned devastated parts of the northeastern seaboard while towns are still rebuilding. As we speak, they could literally be wiped off the map again in just a couple of storms that quickly come and go, and then life has been changed dramatically. So explain from your insights, please, the difference therein between adjusting to gradual change, economic, political, social, and then dealing with drastic change in our lives.
Well, you're absolutely right that we need to be proactive, and this is what my work is about. It has been for the last 7 years or so, or beyond that, really, really preparing emotionally and spiritually for these unprecedented changes. And, you know, what I hope to give in my work is through my books, Manuals for Sanity, Vision, and Inspiration in an Omnicidal World. You know, we should be proactive in the sense of not just considering, well, I'm sitting in hospice now and I'm going to die, so I have to make these changes, but rather looking at the power that we have to really live our lives with unprecedented joy and vision and inspiration and meaning, making meaning as we never have before, reaching out to others and building community as we never have before. Because, you know, as Guy McPherson says, we get to die, but we also get to live. And so for me, it's really about how can I most passionately live my life, whatever the future holds. You know, I think that's a really good way to live.
I would agree with that. I appreciate that insight. What is the best course for us to take to transform despair into positive action? And then second, across the nation, I see in my travels and lectures, angry people, and they're expressing their anger in, I consider, unproductive ways. Anger is turning into militias of race hatred or dysfunctional masculinity. That's the whole military-industrial complex. Shouldn't people confront their anger towards Washington, Wall Street, multinational corporations, Monsanto and others, in a more constructive way, even going to some of the Gnostic texts, I believe the Acts of John, the images of how we should deal with destructive moments in our lives?
Well, absolutely, Gary. I totally agree with you. And for me, what I see is that we have covered up so much of our grief with anger because we don't have permission in this culture to grieve. So a lot of my work is about helping people grieve and also helping them deal with their fear, their despair, and helping them create joy in their lives as well. If people want to go to my website at carolynbaker.net, they can find a 5-part series that I've written lately called What Collapse Feels Like, and I deal with these big 5 emotions. And in the work that I do where I travel and do workshops, I do a lot of assisting people to tap into their grief, because what people find repeatedly is that when they tap into their grief, it heightens their sense of joy and aliveness. And, you know, they're still holding some anger, but they're not lashing out. They're not doing self-destructive things. And they're really getting down to what is under their anger that is causing them so much pain. So it's an enormous release and healing process when we can get into our grief deeply.
I appreciate you coming on the program and sharing your insights with us. Her book is Collapsing Consciously. The website is carolynbaker.net. Thank you very much, Carolyn, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you for listening, and please let people know that tomorrow, a very important commentary, the full hour, The Hidden Hand, will take an in-depth look at how the world has gotten to be the mess it is and what we need to do to change it. Thank you very much for listening. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, I get a lot of emails, and this is a common one, so those are the emails that I read. When I get a lot of one theme of an email, I like to read. This comes from Jimmy, and he's been a teacher, a public school teacher, for over 25 years. And he says, Gary, I've noticed that in the last 5 years, there's been a substantial decline in the quality of the educational system. There seems to be more emphasis these days placed on testing and getting passing grades rather than learning. And what's worse is that there's more confrontational input from parents who refuse to accept that their sons or daughters are either acting out, not focused, undisciplined, or even just lacking interest in learning. So if they get a bad grade, they rant, they yell, and they threaten. He says, frankly, I'm sick of it. The entire system has been corrupted in education. And he asks, what are your thoughts on what we can do to change the system?
Stop being cynical. And I believe that too often we are cynical for all the wrong reasons. There is a saying, a cynic is not merely one who reads bitter lessons from the past. He is one who is prematurely disappointed in the future, which means that we have no place to go. We look behind, we're angry at what we did, said, and didn't change, didn't learn its lessons, and almost always we're angry when we cannot come up with a tangible way of having learned something that strengthens us, empowers us, and prevents us from replicating the mistakes of the past. Most people are reasonable enough to realize that any system is only as viable as the people that support it. We have a different type of support system today. If you're a teacher today and you want to teach students in your class how to think, not just how to pass a test, the high probability is that you'll be criticized. In some cases, you'll be removed to a rubber room where you'll be paid a salary, but you'll be going every day and just reading inside of a room. You won't be allowed to teach. It's like an educational purgatory. You're between heaven and hell. Parents today, more often than not, if they're the typical parent, if a child brings home a poor report card, will go and scream and yell or denounce or demean the teacher, accuse the teacher. My kid is too smart. My kid is too good to have deserved this grade. The teacher's then put into a situation that makes it impossible to reason. After all, there was a time when if you and I got a report card, it was fairly accurate what we did. The report card wasn't based upon someone liking or disliking, it's based upon what we did in the context of that class and room, and where we therefore had to own it. We had to be held accountable for it. So when you have parents who don't know how to parent, when you have parents who do not set appropriate boundaries, spiritual boundaries, physical boundaries, manner boundaries, where there's no consequence to acting out, then the likelihood is that the child will perceive themselves as being unique and better and without that discipline. And that child will not find a good fit in the existing system. Or you'll have a highly motivated child who has gotten a lot of good input from the parents and frequently finds that the classroom is limited because they floated the scale. They take the weakest dimmest student and balance it out with the strongest so that you have a medium. Just imagine if you asked Michelangelo or Picasso to put on a blindfold before they went to the canvas or to the stone to chisel. We shouldn't limit those who have gifts and skills and interests and curiosity, nor should we reward those who don't. And that's not going to change. The system will not change. It's too corrupt. There's too much money. It's being privatized. And so the only thing we can look forward to is when a system finally collapses, ask ourselves, can we learn the lesson of this collapse? If we can, then we'll be, other than cynical, we'll be motivated to do it better. I believe that before we get there, there'll be smaller communities that will understand some of the virtues of proper education and instill those and create systems that allow proper education, where the student, the learner, the teacher, the overseer, and the parents work together for the common good of manifesting as much in the way of input in a healthy way to that child as possible, to prepare them for the real world in a way that's both positive but realistic, and also does not leave out the importance of the arts, history, culture as a part of that flowering of intelligence. Hope that answers the question.
Sure does.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Let us now say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Hello, Luann, if you're still there. Today it is open forum, excuse me, so it's wherever people want to take the conversation.
Great. We look forward to another hour with Utrice Lead.